Right, we ready?
Guess so.
Ready.
Sounded interested, Ed.
Sorry, I've had to go clothes shopping. It's really taken it out of me. F***ing hate clothes shop.
New jacket.
New trousers to set off my rocking jacket.
Right. How much were them? 700 quid?
No, I spent two pairs of trousers. I think it was 52 quid, which I don't think is too bad. One was Debenhams, one was M&S.
Debenhams, are they still alive?
I like Debenhams. It's got nice stuff.
Oh, God, grim.
Grim?
Yeah, I hate Debenhams. It's really bleak. Something about it's so bleak.
I think
what are the shops
Debenhams
like you around your way like? You hate Game. You hate Debenhams.
It's Blue Water, darling, down here. It's all their fancy labels.
Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast. Joining me for this edition, our assistant editor, Steve Withers.
I've been listening to my guts since I was 14 years old, and frankly speaking, I've come to the conclusion that my guts have got shit for brains.
Games editor, Mark Botwright.
Do you have soul?
Audio reviewer, Ed Selly.
Liking both Marvin Gaye and Art Garfunkel is like supporting both the Israelis and the Palestinians.
And Steve Hill.
Do you even know your daughter? There's no way she likes that song. Oh wait, is she in a coma?
Like I said, that is one of the best lines of the movie. Right, let's move on. Let's talk quickly about something which has taken up, I would imagine, everybody's time this weekend. If you're
sad bastard with nothing else
sad
to do.
Sad with nothing else to do, yeah. Thanks for that, Steve. Season 2, House of Cards, who's been watching it?
I'm a sad bastard with nothing else to do, so I've watched most of it.
My wife has been ploughing through it quite enthusiastically. I haven't had the time yet. I want to preserve it in a state of perfection, so I shall leave it for a little bit.
We're about to give away spoilers.
I don't care.
No, we're not.
Are you really?
No.
I've only seen one episode.
Yes, same here. I only had the chance to see episode one, although it was an absolute belter of an episode.
I was left numb.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant, and it's set up now, so I'm really looking forward to it. Steve, you're on episode 9. Does it get better?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's great. It's what I love about the show is that just when you think it's going in one direction, as you just mentioned in episode 1, it suddenly goes in a completely different direction. And even though you really shouldn't kind of be like root for Frank because he's a bit of a scumbag, you do. And the way they play against other people is. You play off against other people is brilliant.
I think this time around, now that we've got season 1 out of the way, we know who the main players are. There's only one new cast member so far that I've noticed that's come in. We know who everybody is. It's now time to get down and dirty and nasty, and that's what I'm looking forward to.
There are more cast members coming in terms of new characters, and no matter who you are, no one's safe.
And I think Kevin Spacey is absolutely bang on the right person to play Frank.
Well, I mean, I'm quite familiar. I don't know anybody else. I'm familiar with the original BBC series with Ian Cuthbertson. Is it Ian? Ian Christ, what was his name?
Ian Richardson.
Ian Richardson, thank you. Ian Richardson playing the part of Francis Urquhart. And he was so brilliant in it. Initially, I was hesitant to think, can somebody else play that role and do it just as well? But Spacey knocks it out of the park. I mean, he is amazing in it, particularly when he breaks the fourth wall and talks to the audience. Some of it is just hysterical.
Did they do that in the original?
Yes. Yeah, they did.
Oh, they did. Okay. Much fun. I love that. It's great.
Yeah, but there should be more of that, I think. I love the whole talking to camera and, it's a little thing between you and the character and so on. I think it's a really well done. Really well
it's not done that often, and funnily enough, it is done in the film that we were quoting when this started. I can't think of that many films where a character breaks the fourth wall and talks directly to the audience. They do it in the film we were quoting in the beginning of this podcast. They do it in Alfie, both the original and the remake, and they do it in
Wolf of Wall Street. I think he does it at some point.
Yeah, you're right. He does. Yeah, he does break the fourth wall.
I think he does.
Yeah. But it is unusual, and it is quite funny when it's done well. It's very good.
Edward Norton doesn't talk to the camera during Fight Club, but it is narrated.
Yeah, it's narrative. Narration, though, isn't quite the same as actually talking directly to the camera. I think that's relatively unusual.
Of course, Spacey does that in American Beauty.
He does as well, yes, you're right.
It's been years since I've seen it. I need to go back.
He's narrating it, isn't he, again? I don't want to say any more because I might, if you haven't seen American Beauty, I'll be giving away too much. It's a bit like talking about
because it's
Sunset Boulevard.
Well, no, it's spoilers at this point, it's surely fair game. How many years has it been?
Yeah, plus it actually starts at the end.
Does it start with him?
The movie opens with "I am dead."
And, oh right, and... no, okay. In that case, it doesn't. Sunset Boulevard doesn't give away that particular trick until the end of the film. So.
Mr. Bortright, you're rather quiet on this. House of Cards fan?
Not watched any of it, I'm afraid.
Not at all. It's the only reason to have Netflix, mate.
Oh, the only reason to have Netflix, but it's a good reason. To have Netflix.
It is for me.
I've been quite enjoying that. They sucked season 5 of Star Trek: Next Generation up the other day. I was plowing through a couple of those the other day. I quite enjoyed it.
Well, I've got to say, with Netflix, I've always kept it on the plasma. I've never moved it onto a bigger screen, but I did on Friday night. I got the new JVC in, so I set it up for that, and I was expecting the worst for House of Cards episode 1. Got to say, the quality, even on, I mean, that's a 10-foot screen that I have. It's shot 2:1. It's 2:1. So even when I zoomed it out for the scope screen, it was still really impressive in terms of image. I mean, there is band in there and so on, but in terms of what you're watching, which is a stream, I've not got a great internet connection. It still looked bloody good.
Yeah, I'm always amazed at how good it looks, considering, you know, like you, I've a copper wire basically coming into my house, and it's quite impressive. So let's hope, you know, with their promises of 4K delivery, that they're equally as impressive with the high resolution stuff.
Well, the problem with Netflix, and it's certainly a problem that they're having in the US, is a lot of these ISPs are actually starting to strangle people's connections because they're streaming so much from services like Netflix. They're not doing that in the UK, as far as I'm aware, ISPs, but it is an issue in the US at the minute. Let's hope that doesn't come over the pond, because that's the last thing you want, is services like that not being able to provide what is really quite a good service. And like I say, I was surprised with the quality. Now, I don't know if they're going over and above just to make House of Cards look the best it can look, because I haven't tried it.
Surprised.
That is their flagship show, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
I haven't tried it with any other content yet. I've only watched, one episode, and then I had to do some work, so I haven't had a chance to.
But I watched a bit of Breaking Bad on a projector, and again, I thought that's very, very watchable, even on a large screen. So I don't think it is just House of Cards. I think, you know, with their super HD, whatever that's supposed to mean, super HD stuff, the resolution's pretty good. The lack of compression and banding artifacts is actually quite impressive.
Do the Netflix clients vary machine to machine? Because I think I've got a WDTV box.
Yes,
and I use
do.
Netflix via that. But the client is just so bad to navigate and search for things.
Yep.
I think that is a big part of what puts me off using it.
Yeah, it varies from device to device. I mean, the Apple TV is what I use, and it's not as feature-packed as using the actual web portal where you get everything. I mean, season 1 of House of Cards, there is a David Fincher commentary track, which you can't get that on the Apple TV. You can only get that through the web portal, as far as I'm aware.
Really?
Although the Apple TV portal is a lot slicker than a lot of the other ones on, you know, TVs and that sort of stuff.
I was quite impressed with the one on the Panasonic. I got it on the. I was using it on the PS3, and I have to say I was expecting the worst, because every other implementation on that Panasonic smart TV is bobbins. But actually, I was quite pleasantly surprised. It's quite slick and it's easy enough to find stuff. So I don't know how much scope they give different companies to tinker about with it, but it's perfectly usable for me.
Yeah, I think I just want to discover stuff on it. I just want to kind of stumble across something, and that isn't. If you're searching for something, it seems okay, but to kind of browse, it's not really that fun.
Yeah, it's really quite limited in terms of browsing. That is the one thing that annoys me about it is browsing on it. It's not something you can go in and just hit random, basically, which is what I would like to do, just hit random and then see what pops up.
Aren't you supposed to be able to license the Scrabble feature from Last.fm? I'm sure I read that somewhere that they were hoping to make, because I don't know if anyone's used Last.fm. They're if you like this, you may also like software. It's really very clever, and it learns almost as fast as Amazon's "You may also be interested in" software. So which is saying something. And I was under the impression that was something that they were hoping to market in its own right, because it's very clever, it's very adaptive, and it learns people's listening or viewing habits very quickly. And I have to say, that would be a very happy combination indeed.
The other plus point with Netflix, which people, I think, forget about, is using unblocking services like Unblock Us. Really easy to do, and it gives you access on your Netflix account to every region that Netflix is available in. And all you do is you just set the region via their webpage, and your box then works in that region. So you can go to US, Canada, Mexico, France, Spain.
Spanish language stuff.
Yeah. If you like European softcore porn, then that's the place to go.
Well, I mean, now Channel 5's moved out of that market. We are looking for someone to take up the bat, so to speak. And that's not a euphemism.
Emmanuel 12 or something like that.
Oh, a minor classic, that one. But did you see Kevin Spacey talking about... Obviously, he was bigging up House of Cards, understandably, but he was talking about how Netflix, and I don't disagree with this, Netflix has changed people's viewing habits to a degree. People want they don't want to be told when to watch things and how to watch things. If they want to watch the entire series in one hit, they can on Netflix, which is the great thing about it. So on Friday, you could log on and you had the whole of House of Cards season 2 to watch, and you could watch it in one sitting if you wanted to. What about if you just didn't have actual episodes? So instead of having 13 episodes, it was just one 13-hour piece.
Oh, no.
But you just dip in and out when you want to. You just stop it, and come back.
Peter Jackson's got that core of the market fairly nailed down.
No, but I mean, when you read a book, it doesn't have, I know it has chapters, but it doesn't necessarily have a cliffhanger at the end of each episode, does it? I mean, you can just dip in and out.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, but when you stop, you normally stop at the end of a chapter when you're reading
a
book.
Or at least a decent break. That's what made Tom Clancy the greatest airport fiction writer there's ever been, because there's just useful, proper stop points. There's at least 3 a chapter, and then obviously there's chapter stops as well. That's what makes it perfect. It's like, oh, my station's coming up, I'll stop here. Perfect. So you'd still need to, even if you did it as a continuous thing, I still recognize the benefit of chapters or at least some form of internal segregation, not simply remembering where you last picked off.
Well, I don't think Netflix can lay claim to it. I think they can kind of lay claim to acknowledging it. I think people did it with torrents and piracy for
box
ages
sets,
where they just
DVD
hoard
box
up.
Sets,
yeah, exactly.
But it is saving a fortune. When it comes to that kind of thing, I mean, if you think about it, $5.99 a month?
Oh, it's so cheap. Amazing.
I'm not kidding. I've watched 5 seasons of Fringe. I've caught up on 4 seasons of Dexter, 3 seasons of The Office, Californication. And basically, it's saved me an absolute fortune in TV box sets. It's paid for itself for the next 10 years already.
Like, I signed up for House of Cards season 1 and I never got round to closing the subscription, and here we are season 2, and I'll probably end up leaving it again till season 3. So I guess they're kind of got their tactics right.
Well, it must be said, in terms of discretionary spending, they're on at $5.99 a month, they're on very, very safe ground. I mean, that and the $9.99 I spend on Spotify are something catastrophic would have to happen before I knock them on the head. Because
what's the $9.99 I'll pay? I think I pay $4.99 for Spotify.
Because I put it on, it gives me it's premium on, and then premium on mobile device as well.
All right, okay.
So, because admittedly, I don't use that as much as I used to, but when I commuted, and also now I'm on Android, it means that I can still use the ghost of my iTunes account, because Spotify fills in any gaps it has with my iTunes account and then still syncs wirelessly with an Android phone, which is quite handy.
My wife and I have had stand-up rows where I've tried to use Spotify on my mobile while she's at home trying to use it at home, and it keeps stopping on one end or the other as we keep
trying
to.
The only way you can do that, if you've got it downloaded, if you've got the material downloaded to the actual device, you can then force offline.
That would take planning, though. Sometimes I time it just right. I go into a tunnel and the app doesn't know, and we both get away with using it for maybe 5-10 minutes.
Those two things, sub £20 a month, and that's all of my ability to find new music that I want to buy on physical formats, and all the filling in the gaps of television that were previously, I don't know, being filled by me watching QVC or something. So,
yeah, let's not get back to the daytime TV fodder. Another new series, which is into episode 3 now, I don't know if you guys watch it, it's Top Gear. Gotta say, absolutely disappointed with it this year. It has been terrible. Anybody else seen it?
I watch it as a matter of, I record it and then I'll watch it later on. Terrible is a strong word. I think it's important now not to regard it as a motoring show. That's the first way of avoiding any confusion. I feel that the piece with the McLaren P1 as good as anything that's been done.
That's the only highlight of this show so far, because it was the only time. I mean, Top Gear was famous for brilliant cinematography. I mean, absolutely brilliant cinematography when they did car reviews and so on. The way that they used filters, the way that they positioned the cameras, a lot of the shots that they did, aerial shots, all that kind of thing. That's what they were famous for. It was quality 5-10 minute slots where it looked gorgeous and it was entertaining to watch. Now it's these stupid bloody challenges every week, and you know they're going over the same old ground. I mean, this week it was Super Minis. They've done that in the past. It's just, you know, think of something new, and the humour is just so forced now. It's just, you know, it's past its sell-by date as far as I'm concerned.
I did quite enjoy the piece with the Alfa 4C, but that's because I, against all logic and reason, rather like Alfa Romeos, and I'd quite happily sell Withers to slavers.
Yeah,
got a 4C.
I would as well. I thought it was absolutely gorgeous.
I mean, don't get me wrong, £45,000 for a small plastic car.
Yeah, completely impractical.
But nonetheless, I think it's nice to see Alfa Romeo making little sports cars again. And I thought that was nicely shot as well, and I thought that was good. I felt that, I will say, it's unusual to say this, but I think actually the guests this season have been actually a redeeming feature as well. I mean, James Blunt remains remarkably likeable when he's not singing. Tom Hiddleston's always good value. And Hugh Bonneville is a bit righteous, but again, I think they've had three good guests.
His jumper.
Well, he does seem, if you know, he did the Deadliest Roads thing. He was rocking some serious knitwear in that as well. So it's obviously what he chooses to do.
His mum keeps making them wear them.
It must be said, those World's Deadliest Roads things that BBC did, it depended very much on whether it was lovies or people I didn't want to punch doing it. But there were some cracking pieces for that as well, it must be said. I thought that was one of the best motoring programmes that's been done recently. Well, but if you are interested in motoring programmes, obviously Fifth Gear
back
kicks
on
off
Monday.
On Discovery, yeah.
Yeah.
Presumably replacing Air Crash Investigation.
It's the last one tonight, Air Crash Investigation. So it's Fifth Gear next week. And I'm actually looking forward to that because they actually review cars in that one.
Well, yes. Although that said, I don't know, Phil and I will have to debate this. The last week's episode of Air Crash Investigation, Air Not Crash Investigation. And then I think this evening is also Air Not Crash Investigation. So I think...
So you mean there's no crash in it?
I have noticed that this season that they've actually gone back to some that they covered in the past as well and redid them. So we need more plane crashes, basically, so they can...
This is not good,
death,
what I was saying.
Death,
it's not what I was saying, but there's less and less plane crashes for them to actually cover now. Unless they start actually
last year was the safest year ever in flying history, because there was no major crashes last year. So there you go, 2013 was the safest year.
I mean, some of the things that happened in the 60s and 70s are proper horrifying, you know, and they already did that one from the early 50s that was like Mad Men with plane crashes. And I think that points to the way forward to me.
So sideburns and flares is the way to go.
I mean, don't get me wrong, last week's one, flying around in a hurricane, was quite cool, but... Yeah, I mean, you know, when they interview everybody, that fundamentally, if there was a crash, it was a bit of a lame one. So,
yes, we want more death and destruction, so we can have documentaries about it.
I don't know. I think I'm on a better position by simply saying we should revisit historical ones rather than asking for fresh ones. But you know, either or, yeah, more fireballs, please.
Well, the confusing one today was that guy that hijacked the plane, who was the co-pilot. Ethiopian Airlines.
The co-pilot that hijacked it.
Yeah, it was a co-pilot that hijacked the plane.
Where
did he fly to? Was it Switzerland?
Yeah.
He was going to Rome, so why did he not just land his normal in Rome and then claim asylum there? It was
Switzerland is non-EU, and there are different terms in terms of claiming certainly political asylum. They don't give it out very often, but when they do, you're very untouchable. So yeah, I don't know what it depends. But it must have been a hell of a working day. It's like morning. You're right. Yeah, not bad, not bad. Oh, yeah, by the way, if you don't mind putting your hands behind your head, I'm taking this plane to Switzerland.
I'm taking control of this plane.
Are you winding me up? Or
where were they flying from?
They were flying from Ethiopia. It was Ethiopian. They were going to Rome. So it was Ethiopia to Rome. Yeah. So he just kept going. He did. Basically, the captain got up to go to the loo, so then he locked the captain out. at the cockpit.
And presumably, as Ethiopians go, he's probably doing all right.
He's a co-pilot on an airline, doesn't it? Of the most hijacked airline.
The other thing is they've all got brand new planes as well. I don't understand that one. They must be doing really well because they always have up to date aircraft, like pretty new aircraft as well.
Oh, it has a pretty good safety record. Weirdly, well, I said no, not weirdly. It's quite a well regarded airline.
So you won't be seeing it on aircraft investigations.
Well, he said disappointedly. Well,
hang on. You will be getting Ethiopian Airways because their Dreamliner was the one that caught fire at Heathrow.
And they did feature. They featured because one of their pilots was the first guy to actually have anyone survive a landing on water. I mean, he didn't do as well as that bloke on the Hudson River, but he was, to be fair, landing in the Indian Ocean. So
the one that's on film where you see it cartwheeling.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a pretty cool shot.
There's only 100 people died in that one, Steve. But
most of the people
cool.
that died in that were because they inflated their life jackets too soon. And I have long maintained that during the safety briefing, they need to say, if you inflate your life jacket before the plane land and you're told to do so, you will float up to the top of the compartment and drown. They need to make it abundantly clear why you shouldn't do it, because people lack imagination. You need to tell them, this will do, that you need to do it this way or you're just going to die.
But Ed, I've seen those life jackets. I'm fairly sure you could get one off if you needed to.
Yeah, but then you don't have a life jacket, which is going to be a problem if you're going to spend any significant amount of time bobbing it. I mean, I'm hugely buoyant because I'm full of air, but that may not be something that everyone has the luxury of enjoying.
You just admitted you're full of hot air.
Yeah, pretty much.
I think, in fairness to Ethiopian Airlines, if it's the co-pilot that hijacks the plane, there's very little you can do about that, is there, really? You can lock the door as much as you like, but presumably he used that lock to his advantage in the event he had to hijack.
The problem inside the cockpit, yeah.
Well, I mean, while we're talking about aircraft, this technology is really rapidly advancing. I've read a few stories this week about airlines now getting rid of the TVs in the back of the seats. They're putting new entertainment systems in, which are going to be fully Wi-Fi, and you need to bring your own tablet or mobile phone to use the system, or you'll pay 14 quid a time to hire a tablet. I've got to say, the last thing I want on a plane is access to the internet.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know, I caught the train up to Norwich. I know it's not the same thing, but I caught the train up to Norwich the other day, and I just
living
watched
the dream.
Match of the Day, and then Sunday Supplement, all on Sky Go, all the way up, and it was like being at home. It was great. Loved it. Best journey of my life.
Yeah, but the thing is, I think a long-haul flight, you know, we're stuck with screens everywhere we go these days. I mean, everywhere you go, it's tablets and mobiles and all that, people talking on them and just really annoying things. And the best thing about a long-haul flight is you get on and nobody can use their phones to make calls and stuff, so you haven't got some arsehole sitting behind you talking at the top of his voice. And you can actually sit and relax, and you don't have to switch the screen on. You can sit and relax, and it's, 9 hours away from the Daily Grudge?
No, I totally agree with that, but I'd still like the idea of being able to hop on YouTube or, I don't know.
When on flights where they do have internet access, I don't know if everyone else experiences this, but on anyone in my Facebook list or on Twitter who's on a plane with internet access, the only thing they do is like, I'm on a plane and I can access the internet, LOL. And then that's it. You don't hear from them again.
Yeah, I mean, the other downside to that is at the moment you can get on a long-haul flight and you know you don't have to do any work. If there's an internet connection, you just know that you're going to have to do some work.
Most of my work can be done offline. I haven't had that excuse for years, unfortunately. Gutted.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good idea. Right, so we went completely off track there. We started at season 2 House of Cards. Don't know why or how we managed to get to where we are. So let's wrap up quickly on home cinema news. It is the Bristol Sound and Vision Show this coming weekend. Starts on Friday, goes through Saturday and Sunday. Tickets are available if you go to the website. It's a pretty reasonable ticket price. I think it's about 7 quid.
It's 10 quid.
Is it 10 quid now, is it?
It's £18 for two.
Right. Okay, which is quite reasonable, seeing that you've got at least 4 or 5 floors of stuff to go and look at. It is tends to be quite heavy on the hi-fi side of things, but there is the vision side of things as well. So Steve and Ed are going to that. What are you looking out for?
Yeah, if you're a projector fan, you'll be able to see the latest JVC projectors. They're always there with their little area, and just next to the main entrance. In fact, just as you come in to the left, there'll be JVC. So they'll be there with the, I'm not sure which projector it will be, but they'll be there with one of the new lineup, either the one I just reviewed or the one you're just about to review, Phil. And then if you go up a few stories to the Optoma room, they'll have the HD91 LED projector there that I reviewed recently. So again, if you're interested in projectors, that's worth checking out. Over to you, Ed, on the audio side.
Sony's normally there, are they not, Steve?
They are, although I don't know what...
I don't think the VW500's had a public outing yet, has it?
It's true. Could show the VW500. But they don't tend to have... did they do... Yes, they have done projectors in the past. Yeah, maybe. They could have the VW500 there, which would be good.
Okay, so that's a vision side. Shows you how little that is. It's more a hi-fi show, Ed. So what are the things to look out for there?
First UK demonstration of the name statement. The one horsepower, 100 and something thousand pound pre-power amplifier. Steve and I have got our exclusive tickets for the Journo Dem. It's sort of a mark of quiet enthusiasm that I'm ticket number one, and I think Steve's ticket number.
I'm ticket number four.
Which I didn't see that coming, but yeah. I don't get me wrong, it has as much to do with the reality of even someone that's pretty keen on two channel like me, it has as much to do with the reality of what I'm buying as it does the space shuttle, but I still want to hear it. I still want to know what it can do. And then across that, there will be, if it's anything like a normal Bristol, there should be at least four or five rooms where it's not like, think, oh, that's all right. You should listen and think that. Bloody excellent. And normally at least two of those rooms are also accompanied by a price tag which isn't a telephone number as well, so you know, we'll see what there is. And there should be at least one example of a turntable which has me contemplating selling a kidney. That's just how it should be, and I'm not normally disappointed, so we'll see. And obviously for those sort of podcast people that are, you know, have been following this, I will be wearing the coat for the duration of the time that I'm there. So
so come up, throw eggs at him. You
can
know,
make sartorial comment. I nearly got gloss paint on it this morning.
If you do see us, please don't be frightened. Come up and say hello. I'll talk to the member.
Steve, don't do that. You get all f***ing nutters coming up.
As long as my nemesis is there, it's fine.
So, who's that?
Who's that?
I don't know. But there is one man. I'm not, no word of a lie. As you can imagine, I've been going to hi-fi shows for a long, long time, and I've been going to them around the world. And there is one man I have seen at every single show I've ever been to, and he's not a member of the trade. And I don't know who he is, but he's there at every single show, and I just regard him as my nemesis. He probably is a very nice bloke, but he's there at all the shows. And it's really
he
weird.
Pulls a knife head on running.
We used to have no, I'm not going to talk about it because you might listen to the podcast. We've had some strange people come out and speak to us. Let's just leave it at that and move on swiftly. So,
but generally, everyone's very nice.
Yes.
In my experience. People that have come up to say hello to me have always been quite friendly.
Well, the best one was Russell, the year Russell went, and he complained to you at the end of it. He said, why are people not come up and said hello and stuff?
That was so funny.
And you said, well, it's probably because nobody knows what you look like because you're not on the videos and you haven't got your photograph. And the next day, his forum profile had his photograph.
Yeah. He was gutted that not one person came up to him to say hello.
Right, okay, that's enough for home cinema. We're going to move on swiftly, and come up next is games news. Titanfall, we're going to start with that one, guys.
Yeah, yeah. Can do, yeah.
Right, okay, I'll come in with that.
they're pausing it at the moment.
You're playing it, aren't you?
No, I can't, because it's an online game, so for once I've got to actually sit here and listen to this.
Good.
And you sound so happy about that.
Right, anyway, games news, Titanfall, tell us all about it, guys.
Do you want to jump in on this one, Steve?
You've been waiting years to be able to say that, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, Titanfall came out in beta this weekend. Initially, you had to apply via a website and wait for a code. So we were all sitting waiting by our email boxes. And I never got one, actually. So I had to go and scrounge one off the forum in the end. But as it panned out, I think the beta is now going to be open to all. So by the time this goes out, anyone who wants to play it should be able to play it. It's good. I quite like it. it's definitely got the air of Call of Duty about it. But one weird thing, they seem to populate the game half with bots, so characters which are controlled by the computer, and they're thick as shit. It's like shooting fish in a barrel.
I think that's actually quite a smart idea. I started off kind of really disliking that whole idea of the fact that you'd almost be wasting time on these things. You know, they're no great threat. From a distance, it can kind of confuse you as to where, you know, the players are, you know, the real threats are. But it kind of gives you, it makes it such an accessible game because there's always someone, something there that you can be shooting, you know.
Yeah, but they're so bad. Like, you'll see them stacked up in a doorway and you'll just be picking them off, or you'll run around a corner and there'll just be two there doing something odd to each other. And I understand the reasons why they've done it. You know, they're trying to hide any kind of lag issues and maybe boost people's egos a little bit. But I feel a bit of a fraud when I'm playing it. Do you know what I mean?
No, I get that. But I just think that it's almost like there's got to be something there. It feels ridiculously easy to get into this game. I mean, I am really poor at shooters. I mean, I've got the kind of weak reactions coupled with natural inclination towards cowardliness.
You're still getting over your man flu as well.
Yeah. That's a good point. But with these kind of, you know, they say they're not bots, but you know they are. They're just kind of AI that wander about. They are very easy to kill. But it gives you a nice kind of easy in to the game. You know, there's something there for anyone, for kind of all skill levels. So it never really feels the same as, you know, when you're the first person to kind of jump into, you know, Call of Duty or Battlefield, and you're like a month late and everyone else has got, you know, far better kit than you, you just feel like, you know, you're kind of running through treacle there. Whereas this, you know, okay, it's still the beta, but it just feels like there's always something there for you to do. You're kind of contributing. And the thing that I love about it is that, you know, I kind of end up very much on the poor end of the scoring system as usual, but it never really feels like it's kind of penalizing you. You know, it just feels like they've kind of emphasized the fun of it rather than that actually trying to chase scores or actually trying to, you know, certainly getting rid of things like kill streaks, I think is absolutely excellent.
Yeah, well, next gen has definitely got its poster boy game, if you like. This is the one that will shift units by the bucket load for sure.
Is it scary?
Scary? No, that's...
I'm playing it, Phil.
All right, that's what I was going to say. So the games team will play this one.
That's the benchmark, yeah, that's the benchmark.
Is it a game intended... So it's being beta tested but intended for release on Xbox One and PS4? Or is it
PS4. It's going to be on PC, Xbox One, and Xbox 360.
It's not really a kind of beta test in the traditional sense whereby you're gaining feedback. It's really kind of like a stress test for the servers and everything.
Stress test, bit of a demo, show it off, you know, build a bit of the hype.
So you're still going to have to buy it then?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you still got to buy it. And it's online only. There's no single player in this game at all.
Right.
It's that trending towards trying to kind of merge, you know, campaigns with multiplayer gaming, so to try and kind of blur the lines. You know, you've got it with the Need for Speed Rivals. There's, you know, you can drop in and out of people's games and that kind of thing. So that's the way that everything's going. And I think that was, you know, the original intention with Microsoft to kind of market the Xbox One as, you know, the always online machine, to have something that, you know, you always had to be online to play.
But somehow EA managed to get everyone's details mixed up. So if you applied for a PC code, they were sending you Xbox One codes, and all the Xbox One owners got PC codes. So it was all a bit of a mess, and they had to set up a website where you could basically get your code exchanged. And in the end, they just started giving out codes to everyone.
I know. For once, I applied for a code and I felt really, I was part of a select group. And then straight away I read, no, we're opening it up for everyone who owns
it. I think it was always going to go open, but it was a bit of an own goal. Them getting everyone mixed up, it made them look a bit daft.
I wouldn't have applied if I thought I was going to be rubbing shoulders with just the common folk.
Thought you were a bit special, would
you? Yeah.
Special needs, more like.
Well, talking about special needs, the games podcast, it went live on Friday. Tell us all about it, guys.
Yep.
I'm not answering that.
Sorry, that was the only end point I had there. It's the only one I was fed.
Nice segue. Yes, GamesPod's out, one of the best ever, download it, or you're missing out.
What's the length of this one? Do I need a bigger SD card?
No. We clocked in an hour and 5 minutes this time, so not too bad.
Slick. Well, probably slicker than this one will end up being.
Yeah. I was going to say, you guys have your moments.
Talk
so
about
sure.
some games at the very least. As opposed to us talking about air crash investigation.
Well, we need feedback on this. I mean, it would appear that we're looking at the comments of the podcast. Some people do go, ah, yes, you actually talked about stuff. Other people seem to be disappointed when we actually stay on the subject matter. they're just waiting for us to
there are definitely two camps.
It's all technology in the end. There's always a technology slant to something, you know.
However says, tenuous, there's always some the sort of technology.
I say there was a time when you could have just changed it to the 4K podcast. At least you're over that.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, the momentum's gone out of that a little bit now, which is good.
And these days, we're the Netflix promotional podcast. Netflix and Spotify should be paying us.
So like Steve said, Games Podcast, it is live. Go and download it and have a listen to that. And we're going to come back in a sec with movie news. So it's that point in the podcast where everybody else can go and have a pee. What's at the cinema, Steve?
Well, this week, Phil, I saw Cuban Fury, which is Nick Frost's new film, and you can just see the pitch meeting for this. Nick Frost does salsa dancing, and that is pretty much it. You know, it's Nick Frost in a sequin shirt and a pair of Cuban heels. He plays a 30-year-old, 30-something, who was a prodigy as a teenager in terms of salsa dancing, but then got beaten up by a bunch of bullies and basically put him off salsa dancing for life. So he hasn't danced since he was about 13, 14. Then his new boss turns up, and it's a woman, and he falls for her and realizes that she's into salsa dancing, so that gets him to want to get back into salsa dancing again. So he has to go back and confront his old teacher, played by Ian McShane, you know, who still has a bit of a grudge for him dropping out of the tournament, the national tournament, in fact, at the last second because of these bullies. And, you know, initially he won't help him out, but he wants to get, you know, to get refresh himself so he can take part in the tournament. It's one of those things. It's all premise and no actual. It's just there's not enough decent jokes.
I'm bored already.
Yeah, no, it is. It's, you know, what I've just told you, the plot's totally predictable. And the jokes aren't that funny. And even though it's got a fairly decent cast, I mean, you've got Nick Frost, you've got Olivia Colman, you've got Chris O'Dowd playing very much against type as a really scummy fellow worker, basically. You've got Rashida Jones, who's, I guess, brought in for the American market, playing the love interest, the boss. Ian McShane, as I said. No, it's got a decent little cast to it, but there just aren't enough jokes. And what jokes are there are not funny. It was like I was sitting there thinking I really want to like this, but frankly it felt like a TV episode that had been stretched across an hour and a half. And looking at the people behind it, the writer has got a history of writing things like Miranda, which gives you an idea.
Who was the writer? I take it Peg and Frost weren't involved.
No, it was the idea is apparently said based upon an idea by Nick Frost, but the actual writer is a guy called Jim Brown, who writes both Fresh Meat and Miranda, which does explain why the film's tone is a bit all over the shop, because it goes from being quite sweet and harmless to having a lot of swearing in it. And it does feel as if tonally it can't decide what it really wants to be. Because I could hear people tutting in the cinema. Obviously, people had come to see it who were a bit older and were a bit offended by some of the language and some of the really filthy jokes that are in it. That did seem a little bit out of place, actually, because it's otherwise a relatively sweethearted movie.
This kind of, it seems like this was a bit of a vehicle for Nick Frost. It's something that he wanted to do, and basically it's not very good. That's what we're saying.
Not really. The one good thing I will say is that the dancing sequences, either when they are doing the dances themselves or they're using body doubles, fat one presumably in the case of Nick Frost, that's actually done quite well. They do that quite well. And there are scenes where you're thinking like, that doesn't look like Nick Frost actually dancing.
I think he did do all the dancing, in fairness to him. I think
there's a couple of things.
It's not exactly Mission Impossible 3, though, is it? It's not hanging off the side of the Burj Khalifa. It's dancing.
I gave it 5 out of 10.
5 out of 10, right. So the next one, I think this is a bit of a dud as well, because it was a vehicle for George Clooney, and everything I've seen about it says it's pretty terrible.
Well, it's been quite harshly reviewed since it came out on last week. It got booed at the Berlin Film Festival, and maybe Berlin was not the best place to show this film. Yeah, it's been criticized, and I think the reason it's been criticized is because it's based upon a true story. So the Monuments Men was a real about 360 guys in total who were put together. They were sort of art historians and architects and these people, and they were put together for two purposes. One was to try and stop Allied troops from blowing up important historic, you know, buildings and pieces of art and that kind of stuff, which was easier said than done, because clearly if you're fighting a battle, the last thing you're concerned about is whether you blow up a particular church or this sort of thing. You don't want to get killed. But also what was happening was the Nazis had been plundering Europe for all the art they could get their hands on and shipping it back to Germany, and their job was to try and get it back before it was either lost to the Russians or destroyed, and then ideally repatriate to the people that it was taken from in the first place. So that it's based upon a true story, and that's an interesting story. I mean, the film opens with a really good shot of the Last Supper mural by Leonardo da Vinci, and the church it's painted on, the wall it's painted on, this church, the whole church has been blown to bits apart from this one wall that was thankfully left, and the locals are covering it with sandbags, trying to protect it, because obviously you had this unique piece of art that was going to get leveled by something. It was the British army that bombed the church in 43 when they were marching, going on their way up Italy. So that kind of image works quite well, and you realize, yeah, okay, there's all this stuff that, you know, could be lost forever because of the worst destructive war in human history. So this, I think the concept, you know, the historical events behind it are interesting. The problem is that the film doesn't know what it wants to be. It's kind of tonally all over the place in terms of, sometimes it's comedic. And other times it tries to be serious. You know, you're dealing with, you know, a devastating war. You're dealing with elements of the Holocaust, because obviously a lot of the painting art is taken from Jewish families who were then sent to the camps. So, you know, that's quite serious. And then you're trying to have jokes and muck about. And I think if they wanted to do a jokey film, because the way the film's promoted is like, you know, the greatest art heist in history. It's like Ocean's 11 with camouflage. And, you know, you've got Matt Damon in it as well as George Clooney, who are both in Ocean's 11 as well.
Matt Damon.
And so the film kind of wants to be jokey in some respects and serious in others. And I don't think it can have its cake and eat it. If they'd picked a completely fabricated story, ideally, like Kelly's Heroes. You know, Kelly's Heroes is about a bunch of guys trying to pitch a load of gold at the end of World War II. You can kind of laugh along with that and have fun, because it's not dealing with anything genuine or serious or real.
Inglourious Basterds is the other.
Well, that's what Tarantino did. Yeah, he basically rewrote history and therefore can't be accused of, you know, he has Hitler being shot in 1944 in a Paris cinema.
And I don't know, I mean, I haven't seen the film. And I understand that this isn't in it, so do correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think it's a spoiler. But once this unit had been formed, one of the authority on religious buildings went off to have a meeting with Arthur Harris, who was the head of RAF Bomber Command, with a list of important religious structures that they felt were not suitable to be levelled by the RAF. And he handed Arthur Harris this list, and Harris went, bombed it, bombed it, bombed it, bombing it tomorrow, bombing it, bombed it, bombed it, bombed it. It's like, well, it's a bit late for that, but thanks for your concern. Handed in the list back and just sent him on his way. And and more often than not, because of the construct of area bombing, the RAF tended to use cathedrals aiming point, because they throw up a very distinctive shadow when you start the fight, because obviously they've got spires and stuff. So they kind of got to him a bit late.
it did make me think that we're probably lucky we've still got as much art left now as we have, considering the amount of damage that was being done at the time. Because for example, the Nazis were taking Hitler was, you know, a big fan of the classical painting, but hated modern art, so they were destroying anything modern. So like a Picasso, that was going to get burnt. So a lot of modern art from the early part of the 20th century was lost forever because the Nazis were systematically destroying it. Because Hitler, you know, if someone had just bought a few of his paintings back in the early 20s, we could have avoided all this trouble.
it's worth pointing out that there is actually a huge amount of art still unaccounted for. Yeah. Almost every single piece of art that was hanging in an embassy in Berlin from either neutral or other Axis states, every single piece of art, including some quite rare and desirable pieces of ancient Japanese, old Japanese art, classical Japanese art, is missing from the Japanese embassy. And it was obviously the Russians weren't too hot on the whole, you know, this is a neutral diplomatic structure. Yeah, it's great. You've got some shiny things, but we'll be having that. So there's a huge amount of stuff.
There was that guy only last year, wasn't it? Who's in Germany, was it in Austria or Germany, where Munich. They went to his apartment? It was full of all this art that he'd been pinched during the war. So I mean, there's all this historic, this real story based that the film's based upon, and obviously there were a lot of Monuments Men in total. I think 360
still exists.
Sorry, what?
The Monuments Men that still exists. The army still has people who they draft in.
All right.
It was never disbanded, so that there's still people looking for stuff.
All right.
Well, yeah, because they were reactivated for the Iraq War in 2003, and a fine job they did of losing absolutely everything.
Well, given there were no weapons of mass destruction either, they weren't going to find much in that war, were they?
So, basically, if you want the real story, there is stuff running on History Channel and Discovery at the minute, obviously tying in with the film, that actually tells you the true story. Interviews the still surviving members of this unit that still exists and missed the film, basically.
Yeah, to be honest, I quite enjoyed the film. You know, the cast is great. You know, it's just that I think tonally the film suffers a bit because it can't decide. And it's full of really heavy-handed exposition too. I mean, it was written and directed by Clooney, and I think he didn't do the great. And also, he doesn't really introduce... obviously, they're trying to distill down all these people into a few characters. So there's about seven guys initially. But they kind of don't introduce them very well, so you don't get to know them before, you know, things start happening to them. So it's difficult to become emotionally involved.
It can't do any worse than Black Hawk Down. That's the worst film in the history of the world.
Black Hawk Down, you're right, should have spent more time, because you can't tell who's who in Black Hawk Down.
No, you can't. Everyone's got the same haircut, and they're wearing helmets. And the debate is like, oh, look, is that
thing about the army, though, isn't it?
But isn't that part of the idea, though, that you don't...
Yeah, that was the point.
The fog of war, you don't know who the hell's who. So maybe
In that case, why bother paying for anyone who was a known actor?
That was another thing in this film. I've seen a clip from it where Clooney and Matt Damon at a bar... And Matt Damon saying, well, we're all middle-aged men. I'm sorry, but Matt Damon, I do not see him as middle-aged.
He's got a dodgy ticker, which is why he's obviously not fighting, because he would have been of age to have been conscripted. He's not actually that old. But the rest of the team are fairly old. To be fair to Clooney, I mean, the direction and the art direction and the production design all top draw. It looks great.
Pun intended, art direction.
Well, I'll use that line, actually, that's good. That looks great. He's out in the review. Finished writing it, yeah. It looks great. So it's a nicely done. So not battle scenes exactly, but, you know, certainly the devastation after a battle and the more normally landings and the troops all assembling and that kind of stuff. So, I quite enjoyed it. But, yeah, I can see why people would have an issue with it.
So score for Monuments Men?
7.
Okay, quickly going through the Blu-rays that are released this week. Blue Jasmine, Machete Kills, Fifth Estate, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, and Game of Thrones Season 3. Which ones stand out there?
Well, none of them, to be honest. I mean, Blue Jasmine, I saw at the cinema. Cate Blanchett's amazing in it. She's probably going to win the Oscar in 2 weeks' time. But I found the film one of those films where you get to the end of it and think, what was the point? Machete Kills is a bit of a laugh. If you've seen the first one, it's more of the same.
That's the only thing I'm looking at buying of the list this week.
It is good. It is good fun. It's got introducing Carlos Estevez as the president. That's Charlie Sheen's real name. It's got who's playing the villain in it?
Professor Mel Gibson.
Yes, Mel Gibson's the villain. It's got quite a good cast, actually. Surprisingly interesting. Got I think Lady Gaga in her first film role, who's quite funny in it. I enjoyed the film, actually, when I watched it. If you want to laugh, that's worth picking up. Fifth Estate, I watched again at the cinema. That's the one about WikiLeaks. Benedict Cumberbatch is very good in it. I quite enjoyed that. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2 is not made by the same team that made the original one. The first one, I thought, was quite fun and charming.
That's a lovely
the guys that made film. That have just made the Lego movie, which is doing storming business in the States right now, and apparently is really good, and I wish I'd gone to go and see that instead of Cuban Fury last night. But apparently Cloudy 2 is not very good. And Game of Thrones Season 3, well, absolutely, definitely, that's the one you want to buy if you're going to buy anything this week.
Providing you've seen 1 and 2.
Yeah, obviously, assuming you're a fan of the show.
All right, quickly, BAFTAs last night, it was on Prime TV. I don't think we need to go through it in too much detail, but give us a quick gist, Steve.
So, best film was 12 Years a Slave, not a massive surprise, although I think Gravity, which won best British film, definition of British film is fairly vague these days, but in all fairness, it was shot entirely in Britain, in Pinewood. All the effects are done in Britain, the producer's British, and Alfonso Cuarón's technically classed as British now because he's lived in London for 12 years. Even though he's obviously Mexican in reality. So they won Best Film and Best British Film, which means they're still neck and neck for Best Film at the Oscars. I've got a sneaking suspicion that gravity is starting to gain a bit of momentum, actually. No pun intended again. And I could see that maybe sneaking 12 years, because I found 12 years a difficult film to kind of relate to be honest. It didn't engage me as emotionally as I thought it would.
That's because had you sold into white slavery yet?
Not yet, no. So maybe I'll change my mind after you've done that to me, you bastard. Best actress went to pay. Cate Blanchett got best actress, no surprise there. The guy, Chiwetel, I can't pronounce his sodding name. He won best. I honestly can't. Chiwetel Ejiofor, I could never pronounce it. The guy that plays the lead. In 12 Years a Slave, he won Best Actor. He won't win the Oscar because, for some reason, Matthew McConaughey wasn't even nominated for the BAFTAs, but he's going to take it in the Oscars, I think, in 2 weeks' time. Best Supporting Actor went to the guy that played the main pirate in Captain Phillips. Again, I think Jared Leto will pick up the Oscar. Best Supporting Actress went, surprisingly, not to the girl who's in 12 Years a Slave, but to Jennifer Lawrence, who picked it up for American Hustle. Best Director went to Alfonso Cuarón. Again, he's pretty much a shoo-in now for... Best Director at the Oscars. So the BAFTAs are used as a guideline for the Oscars, and I think it's still pretty open as to who's going to win Best Film. It could be either Gravity or 12 Years a Slave.
Barry Ackroyd was nominated as Best Cinematographer at the
BAFTAs. For Captain Phillips, and I spoke to him last week. Obviously, they were promoting the Blu-ray release of Captain Phillips last week, and I had a chat with him about his work with Paul Greengrass predominantly. So he's worked with Greengrass on Captain Phillips and Green Zone and United 93. And also he won a BAFTA for his work on The Hurt Locker with Catherine Bigelow, which I think you were involved with, Steve, right?
That's correct, yes. Yeah, no, I first worked with Barry Ackroyd back on The Hurt Locker one summer years and years ago now. And I mean, my memory was jogged of it when I saw your article on the site, and all these memories came flooding back. I mean, it was a really, really difficult time for me because they were shooting that movie out in Jordan. So the way dailies work is, you know, normally you're going to get them daily and the lab would process all the film and you'd send it back that day and they could review what they'd done, see where they went wrong, see what they liked, see what they didn't like, blah, blah, blah. But of course, because they were out in Jordan and it was quite difficult getting films out and through customs, we'd get like 10 rolls at a time, which is a lot of work to try and process. And I remember Barry was having a party at his house and he was due to fly back with all the dailies. So we cabbed over all of these dailies over to his house, and the cab driver couldn't find who he was because it was just a house full of people having this party. And he ended up ringing me and I had to ring Barry, and then eventually we finally got the rushes to him, and it was a tough job.
He was a really interesting guy and really friendly to talk to, I've got to say.
He's so talented, and all his work with Paul Greengrass is amazing. Captain Phillips is amazing, and you know, I'm sure they'll go on to make some other great, great films in the future.
So that article is on the site. It's under Movies Interview. It's on the main page. You may have to click more to find it. I think it's second half of the front page. But go and have a read of that because it is interesting. And he is an interesting bloke. And certainly some of the stuff that he comes out with. I was quite surprised that he's quite anti-digital.
Very, very anti-digital. And very anti-3D.
Well, most directors of photography I've spoken to are really against 3D, which... you know, it's not surprising really, but I was surprised with his comments on digital and capturing in digital and so on. So interesting that at least he still prefers film. Right, so to quickly wrap up on this week's podcast, Gravity obviously won at the BAFTAs, and it was made using a lot of the latest technology. It is quite a technical tour de force of a movie. So let's think about, guys, what films would make our top 10 list of movies that have basically changed cinema in a technical way or a creative way. And I'll start first of all saying 1993, Jurassic Park.
Well, that's really annoying because I was going to go with that one. But yeah, I wholeheartedly agree because I was going to go with that one.
But is it Jurassic Park though? Is it Jurassic Park? Because that was obviously the one everyone remembers. But I think it was a bigger risk for Cameron doing T2, where he had a villain that was a CGI villain. And if it didn't work, he was buggered.
Yeah, but the dinosaurs would have looked stupid doing stop motion. So, yeah,
but they were going to do that.
They were going to do it stop motion. Can you imagine how bad it would have been?
If you actually watch Jurassic Park now, do you know, very, very little of it is CGI.
Yeah, there's very little CGI.
Yeah, but they used it very carefully and very effectively.
Which is why it still stands up.
And I don't think that it's a fair comparison to T2, because I don't know about you,
looks
but
very
I
dated.
Don't have much of a reference of what a real liquid metal killing machine should look like. Now, you're about to say, oh, yeah, but you don't have a dinosaur reference either. I do know how a large animal moves through an environment. I was at a zoo yesterday, and it's convincing even 21 years down the line, whereas T2 gets away with a huge amount, because I don't know about you, Steve, but I am very rarely stalked by liquid metal killing machines.
I'm not very often stalked by velociraptors either, thank God.
Yeah, but they're just big chickens, aren't they?
Well, that's the way they've been interpreted, as giant birds, basically.
You need maybe to pick they a better are, class of fast food restaurant, Phil. That is amazing, particularly.
All right, so Jurassic Park.
I think the problem with Terminator 2 is it really hasn't dated very well, I don't think, in terms of effect.
And Edward Furlong is one of the most smackable human beings ever to be put on film.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, we're missing the obvious then. So 1977, Star Wars.
Star Wars, yeah.
Yeah, it basically control. Changed the whole industry, that one.
Obviously, Toy Story, for me.
Well, are we just going on effects, or are we...
No, in so much as it proved that it was more, it was good enough, it looked good enough that you weren't there going, well, yeah, that's great. But it was also, that at the same time, it was allied to enough of a decent film that it was just a means to an end. It was an effective way of doing something.
Yeah, basically, you know, how it changed cinema technically. You know, something like Jurassic Park comes along, then everything CGI fest after that, you know, and it's developed a whole industry on its own. So
if we're going that far, then can we kind of half include, say, The Phantom Menace for overuse of green screen?
I mean, technically... What not to do. Well, we're talking about, you know, innovations, then I guess the jazz singer for introducing sound.
Right, okay.
King Kong.
Have you all seen The Conversation? Gene Hackman?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like the movie that really brought sound mix to the world, I think. That was the one where they really went to town on the audio.
How about The Shining for using Steadicam?
Yeah, definitely. That has to be in.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're going to do that, then... Citizen Kane for the tracking shots.
Yeah, all the hidden cuts and all that.
All the hidden cuts and all the hidden tracks. Dollies.
I've got a controversial one. I think Transformers should be in there.
All right. Explain.
Actually smearing shit onto the lens.
I think it was the first film where they really, truly integrated CG with film pretty much flawlessly. The lighting and the texturing. I think if that film did nothing else... at least set a benchmark.
See, I'd be interested to know what we'll think about that kind of thing in, you know, 20, 30 years time. Because I can remember thinking the same thing about Terminator 2. I can remember thinking at the time, this is absolutely fantastic. You know, you can barely see, you know, where reality and fiction meet. And I think that's kind of the benchmark in every generation. People kind of think that. And then it's only in kind of 20 years time when things get better, that you look back and say, oh, no, it just doesn't age that well.
I have to say, since you mentioned it at the beginning, Phil, which is Gravity, my Blu-ray arrived last week, so I actually watched the extras at the weekend.
I really want to see the extras.
I did not realise just how little of the film is actual, is real. You know, most of the space shots, it's just their faces. Just their faces that are photographed, and the rest of it is all CGI. It's staggering. I mean, the way that they achieved the weightless effects were really clever, because they had the cameras, the actors basically sitting in like buckets, effectively. The camera was on a robot arm, and they were inside a massive, what they call the light box, which was basically LED screens all around the actors so that the reflections on their faces would match the shot. So they pre-vised the entire film from beginning to end, and then did... shots from the POV of the actors, so they could put those on the screens around them as they were shooting their faces, and then they took their faces and put them into the previs, and then they just did the full, you know, the full rendering of the effects. It's absolutely, I mean, what he achieved, because he said to the director of photography at the beginning, you know, beginning of the process, like, it's going to be a simple shoot, two people floating in space. 4 years later, the director of photography was still reminding him that that wasn't quite as simple as he thought it was going to be. But I mean, it takes effects, photography both digital and real, because at the end sequence.
Whoa. Spoilers. Jesus, right. I haven't well, seen the film. Thanks, Steve. You.
Have you really not seen it?
Before this degenerates,
I haven't seen it yet.
An absolute bun fight. a different way of influencing film, and I'm not for a second suggesting it's a great film. It's not a bad film. Blair Witch Project for the first really cracking piece of viral marketing.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was, and that was back in the early days of the internet, really. And that was phenomenal what they did with that. Really phenomenal.
Created a genre.
Yeah, totally.
And then also, I would say, partly because it's one of my favourite films of all time, a completely different subcategory, Apocalypse Now, for a film where it's clearly just consuming absolutely everybody that has anything to do with it. And broadly speaking, they're not acting. They are trapped in a nightmare that they really want to get out of. And that's not them going, "Oh, I'm channeling being trapped in a nightmare." It's like everyone wants to get home.
Yeah, it set the benchmark for how not to make a movie.
Yeah,
recreating Vietnam
is magnificent. But yeah,
that's like Shelley Duvall in the Shining. How to get give a good harrowed performance, terrorizer for months on end.
Did we jump back?
There's a documentary on Netflix. I hate to go back to Netflix. On Netflix called Room 147, where people put forward their insane theories about.
Oh, is that up on Netflix?
It's brilliant.
I've been dying to see that.
147, whichever one it is.
127, I think.
Room 127. It's absolutely brilliant. There are nutters out there, and they have watched The Shining like hundreds and hundreds. And they'll point out this, apparently all this hidden imagery within the film.
JFK
and subtext.
Getting shot.
The moon landings.
Kubrick stayed, is the man who yeah. saved the moon landings.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I watch it. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. It's amazing what people can read into a film.
I think some of the points they've got might be right, like the things about genocide and stuff.
Indian genocide. There are some stuff you think, okay, then maybe he was making a point subtly there. But and Kubrick was a genius, and he was an obsessive compulsive, and he was obsessed with detail. So I could believe that some of that stuff is genuine, but certainly faking the moon landings isn't. And some of the other stuff about sexual subtext was quite funny too. It really is worth watching. It's hysterical.
Okay, well, we've run out of time. So if you've got any suggestions for movies which change cinema in a technical or creative way, list them under the podcast. I'm sure we'll enjoy seeing your nominations for that to make the AV Forum's top 10 list. But that's all we've got time for. We'll be back again next Wednesday. So all I need to do now is thank Steve Withers.
Hang on, I forgot what my quote was.
Always, every week.
This was originally your idea back in the day, wasn't it? Better be worth it.
Well, I've got lots of quotes in this film, but they're all, as Red pointed out,
and I suggest involve swearing.
Oh, we'll do that next week.
Yeah, that's what you're saying, really.
There was a reason for picking this film, because I said it broke the fourth wall.
Yeah, all right.
See? Go on, do some... I can't... Oh, God, what is it? It's 1:30 the monkey's arse. Let's get out of here.
At last. Mark Boatwright.
You guys are snobs.
Steve Hill.
Bye-bye.
And Ed Selly.
Well, that's unfortunate because it sucks ass.
Don't forget you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Bookmark avforums.com for the latest reviews, news and video. Plus, why not leave us a rating on iTunes if you enjoyed the show. Obviously, only if you enjoyed the show. Give us 5 stars. I'm Phil Hinton. Thanks very much for listening. And we'll see you again next Wednesday.
When we might talk about some technology.
No, I don't like talking about technology. I find it limits me in my spurious bollocks, and I find that very
How can we plug Netflix and Spotify if we talk about technology?